This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. Coming up, the world's financial elite may be hiding at least $21 trillion in offshore accounts. Big business gangs up on the Philadelphia public schools, and how black is black radio, really? But first, a new report is out detailing the behavior of New York City's police towards the Occupy Wall Street movement. New York University law professor Sarah Nookey is one of the authors of the study.
We started this study 8 months ago. It's actually a consortium of law school clinics across the United States from a number of different law schools, including NYU and Fordham, Harvard, and at Stanford. And we wanted to examine in cities across the U.S. how different police forces and mayors and other authorities were responding to Occupy Wall Street. So this report is actually the first in a series of city case studies, and this particular report focuses on the response in New York City. There, what we found was patterns of suppression by the NYPD and the city that take a number of different forms. We focus a lot of our investigations on the aggressive, unnecessary, and excessive use of police force by the NYPD against peaceful protesters, but not only protesters, also against bystanders, independent legal observers, and particularly journalists. We also look at the obstruction of press freedoms by the NYPD that includes arrests of journalists, physical assaults of journalists, police officers putting their hands in front of journalist cameras. We have documented the pervasive surveillance of peaceful political activity by police at protests. Of course, the violent late-night raid on Zuccotti Park, which many people are aware of. On top of that particular closure of public space to peaceful assembly, we've also documented extensive closure of other spaces. And these are not usually picked up by the media, but very frequently in New York, the police close down public sidewalks, and in a number of cases have closed down other parks to protesters. In some cases, they've allowed tourists and others to access the park, but have blocked off access only to protesters. We've also documented a wide array of what we call arbitrary enforcement of rules, quote unquote, where the police seek to apply a law that is not in fact a law, and then either give someone a summons or a citation or arrest them for something which in fact is not illegal. One just short example, a protester was on his bicycle. The police were being very strict about various rules, and they pulled him off his bike and tried to give him a summons for not wearing a bike helmet, but there's no rule in New York that requires a person to wear a bike helmet. That's just one example of many different applications by the police of rules that aren't, in fact, legally binding. At the end of the report, we look at the lack of transparency by the police department about what policies it is, in fact, applying to protests. So New York is quite unique in that it does not have a public protest policing guideline that anyone can access so that we all know how the police should be responding to protest. Other cities do have theirs public. We also here have almost no information about what, if any, accountability there has been for any of the many officers who have been involved in alleged misconduct. There's only one officer we know of who's received any sanction whatsoever, and all he received actually was 10 days vacation time docked from his yearly vacation time. In none of the other cases do we have any information about what, if anything, has happened in terms of accountability.
And what does that mean in terms of command and control? That is, how many of these incidents are police following orders, whether you heard them given or not?
That's a great question. So we document a lot of individual cases. At the end of our report, we have a table of 130 separate incidents of alleged excessive police force. For each of those, there were, you know, one or two officers involved in the force. But what's really troubling about them is that in many of those cases, there were many other officers around who did nothing to stop that excessive use of police force or to hold anyone to account. One really clear example for me that I witnessed, a protester was being arrested. He was tackled to the ground by a number of officers. I heard him screaming, so I bent down so that I could speak with him and try and quieten him. I was a few feet away from his face. As I bent down, I saw a police officer pull back his boot and kick the protester really hard right in the face. So So I immediately stood up so I could ID the officer who had done that. I saw his face, but I couldn't see his badge number. So I asked the officer to turn my way so I could see the badge number or to give me his badge number. He refused. A number of us then all saw him and tried to get his badge number. Other officers stood in between us, so we couldn't see his badge number. He walked across the street. His senior commanders came over, pulled a police van, put the responsible officer who had kicked the protester in the face in the van, and they drove off and prevented any of us from trying to get his badge number. So in that case, while it was one particular officer who himself was responsible for the physical assault, all of the other officers present, including senior commanders, were part of attempting to prevent us, which they successfully did in finding out who this particular officer was.
Of course, in the early days of Occupy, we remember commanders, they called them the white shirts, actually applying the mace on protesters and possibly giving the movement a boost by attracting a lot of media attention that had not previously been there.
That's right, yeah. Quite a number of the cases in our report are cases where a quote-unquote white shirt, which means lieutenant or above, is himself, and it is him in most cases, responsible for the assault.
And you have a set of recommendations that you've published in this report.
We do. We've made very clear and concrete recommendations in the first place to New York City authorities. It is New York authorities, of course, the mayor, the city council, and the police commissioner who bear primary responsibility for ensuring that policing here respects civil liberties and human rights. So we have asked Mayor Bloomberg to institute an independent review of the last 10 months of the city's response for a major policy review. We have asked for the city to create the Office of an Independent Inspector General, which would have the independent capacity to oversee the NYPD. And this matches calls from many other groups for years because of well-documented abuses with respect to stop and frisk and the surveillance of Muslim populations. So we're supporting those calls by other groups for an independent Inspector General office, which is standard policing best practice around the world to have independent oversight. We also ask, of course, for accountability for the past abuses. If the New York City authorities do not take good faith steps to implement the necessary changes that I just outlined, we have also submitted our report to the Department of Justice, and we've asked them to step in and to investigate allegations of official misconduct. We've also filed our report as a complaint to various United Nations officials who have the mandate to investigate breaches of assembly rights and expression rights.
Now, I know that you have similar investigations going on in other cities where Occupy was active, and those will be forthcoming. But give us a preview. How does New York shape up compared to San Francisco, Chicago, other locales?
The other investigations are ongoing, so it's a little bit early to say anything about them. But New York, in terms of the allegations of just constant police force, is unique compared to other cities in the United States. There has just been so many well-documented, and it's all on video. Anyone can watch it, of excessive police force. There are other cities where there have been really serious problems of excessive force. Oakland is a well-known one. The one difference with Oakland, at least right now, is that there the city, at the very least, did actually create an independent review of the policies, and they were somewhat more open to criticism. This police department in New York has, at least so far as anyone knows, if it's happened, it's not public, had no independent review. If there's internal review, we don't know what it looks like. So this police department seems unwilling to learn from its mistakes and to reform its practices.
The mayor, Mayor Bloomberg, was hostile to Occupy, to say the least, he being actually himself a member of the 1%. Would you believe that a mayor such as this would like to create an environment that is less hostile, more friendly to demonstrations?
It's his obligation. I don't know about his personal intent, but it's his obligation under both U.S. law and international law that is binding upon the U.S. government, including Mayor Bloomberg as the mayor, to respect the freedoms of speech and assembly.
Well, New York City is not just the biggest city in the United States. It's also a place that the world is looking at. What kind of reputation have the New York City police earned this city?
Since since the report's been published, I've received a lot of calls and emails from lawyers or protesters or observers in other cities saying that they had some better responses from their police commissioners. And their police commissioners were saying things to them like, we do not want to be like the NYPD. And that other police departments in the U.S. were proud of the fact that they didn't have this abusive reputation. But part of the reason that we wanted to do this report was because very, very quickly after the Occupy protests started in New York, they were, of course, in the center of the media's attention on the world stage in this global context of mass social movement mobilization. And so many people around the world were looking to both the protests here and how the police were responding. So very quickly we saw other countries mimicking practice by the NYPD and then seeking to justify their own abuses by referring to the NYPD. Just one example. Shortly after the Brooklyn Bridge arrests, where 700 peaceful protesters were arrested en masse in New York City, in Indonesia there were peaceful protests by 300 or 400 West Papuan activists who were seeking their independence from Indonesia. There was a crackdown on them. All of them were arrested en masse. Some of them were assaulted and taken to jail. When they were criticized by Amnesty International and by Human Rights Watch and others, the president of Indonesia said publicly, how can you all come and criticize me for this when the NYPD just did the exact same thing, only they arrested even more people? And so what we saw was other countries both mimicking and then seeking to rhetorically justify their own abuses by looking here. So what we wanted to do was reestablish what the binding laws are for all countries around responding to protest and making sure that others understand that the NYPD practices are actually not only bad practice, but they violate international law.
So we see the United States calling itself a light unto the nations, but the NYPD is a bad example for the whole world.
In this particular respect, with protest rights, that's exactly right, Glenn.
That was Sarah Nucky, professor of law at New York University. The richest people in the world spend a great deal of effort hiding their money from tax collectors. A report commissioned by the Tax Justice Network, USA, estimates the super rich could be salting away between $21 and $32 trillion in secret offshore accounts. We asked Nicole Tishon, executive director of the Tax Justice Network, how could the rich hide $21 trillion when the entire economy of planet Earth is only $75 trillion a year?
That's an interesting way to put it. One of the things that we struggle with for all of us who try to look at the offshore issue and offshore assets is to try to put a number on what we don't know. And so as we've gone through this process, you know, we worked really hard to try to use as much data as we could to put some numbers on it. And, you know, when you think about how much money goes through these huge banks and even, you know, a lot of them that have been bailed out by the U.S. government, it's really not, it's not that hard to imagine. I mean, we see what's happened with a lot of the dictators that have fallen, and we only find out after the fact that they have all this money socked away.
That is true. Just through the Fed, we've seen something like $23 trillion funneled through U.S. banks on top of all the other activity.
Right. And they're gambling with not just their money, but other people's money, too. And they've turned it into a global casino.
What was the methodology? How was that $21 trillion figure arrived at? And we understand that one of your experts concluded that it could be as high as $32 trillion.
That's right. What our researchers did was they actually went through existing data from the World Bank, the IMF, the United Nations, a lot of the central banks, the Bank for International Settlements, looking at the treasuries for individual countries, and really taking all of that into consideration. And that was part of the what I think is interesting about this is that although this data has been sitting out there, there's no governing body that's ever taken the time to actually analyze it and see if they could come up with these figures on their own.
But that is interesting. And possibly you could keep the existence of $21 trillion away from the New York Times and the rest of the press. But how does one avoid the U.S. Treasury and their counterparts all across the world?
Sure. Just recently, in the last couple of years, the U.S. has started to actually require data from foreign financial institutions with the passage of the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act. And what that does is it requires the institutions to report to the U.S. Treasury the assets of their clients who are U.S. citizens. the sort of incentive for them to do that is that if they fail to adhere to that reporting requirement, they'll be subject to a 30% withholding. So it's kind of holding them a bit hostage when it comes to doing business here, because as a lot of folks know, the UBS and banks in the same vein, they shop around for wealthy individuals. It's been reported that they go to polo matches, they go to country clubs. They really do shop around for their clients and to increase their client base. And the UBS scandal was really just the tip of the iceberg.
Yes, we know that banks, especially banks like UBS, do specialize in servicing these super rich clients. However, the fees on $21 trillion, even if the banks did not invest this money on behalf of these people, just the fees for hiding it would amount to so many billions of dollars, it really is inconceivable that governments would not know about the existence of such hoards of cash.
Right. Until the U.S. actually started requiring this sort of reporting, there was no way of knowing. For instance, with UBS and the Swiss banks, I mean, they're basically hiding behind their own laws that say that the secrecy is fine and it's okay. These individuals have a lot of money. They're willing to pay the fees and pay whatever it takes to keep this money offshore to themselves. And one of the things that we think is most disturbing about this is the fact that governments are not aware of this money and we're losing all of the potential revenues that could be used to provide basic services, to stop all of the cutting of jobs and critical programs all over the U.S. and all over the world. Every government right now is starved.
Yes, your organization, Tax Justice Network, is not just angry that these people hide the money, but that it's a part of a larger problem of income inequality, of a great imbalance in society and in services that government provides.
Absolutely. It shows that there is an ever-increasing gap between the haves and the have-nots. We've seen the banks have bounced back rather well after they were bailed out. And in seeing this continuous narrative of bad behavior and their willingness to really make a profit at any cost, and even if it's serving potential criminals and some of the worst actors in the world.
Now let's talk about this $21 trillion or even $32 trillion and what it could represent in terms of taxable income. The U.S. gross domestic product is only $15 trillion. We're talking about all of these hoarded monies, and I suppose hiding the money should make one liable to a huge penalty if these funds were located.
Absolutely, and that's one of the issues, you know, we're facing right now in the U.S. with the talks of the fiscal cliff and what are we going to do? How are we going to remedy the budget situation? Well, we think that we need to really collect existing taxes, and we don't see this as a tax increase. We see it as collecting the revenues that are out there. You have individuals and as well as corporations who benefit from building their empires here, benefit from our national security, benefit from our roads and our schools and our clean drinking water and their consumer bases here. It's really not fair that they're not contributing to maintaining those services.
One would estimate if there was $21 trillion hoarded out there, at least half would be from U.S. billionaires and trillionaires.
One of the ways our research has put it into context is that if we had taxed the $21 to $32 trillion even conservatively, it could raise between $190 and $280 billion, which is a little more than twice the amount that the OECD countries are spending on all overseas development aid. And what this does is it has a chilling effect for developing countries, because for every dollar of aid that goes into these countries, $10 is coming out in illicit financial flows that cannot be traced and can't be taxed.
Certainly, we've heard from representatives of the Treasury Department who say, see no money, hear no money, smell no money. What's the next step in terms of getting a movement going to find and tax these offshore deposits?
I think that the passage of FATCA was a good first step at getting cooperation. Just today, the U.S. and a number of European countries signed a model agreement where the governments were actually going to be working together to enforce the implementation of the tax through FATCA. And that's one step. I mean, further down the road, we want to be looking at an automatic exchange of tax information. We want to see corporations actually being taxed where they're making their money. We'd like to see here in the U.S. We'd like to end the incentives that we have right now in our system for corporations to move not just their profits, but their jobs offshore. Because we're not only starved for revenues here, we're starved for jobs, too.
Nicole Tishon of the Tax Justice Network USA. Under the Obama administration, federal workers have seen their pay frozen and their characters demeaned. For blacks, federal employment has long been a gateway to job security, but that seems to be slipping away. Lawrence C. Lucas is president of the Coalition of Minority Employees at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Lucas spoke with Warren Jones III, host of the internet radio program New Orleans. Wake up.
Under this administration, who promised us accountability, promised us transparency and diversity, I'm very disappointed that all the efforts that we have made to work with this administration and improve some of these things, both with the secretary and the assistant secretary for civil rights, has gone on virtually deaf ears. We have turned to the White House. We've sent many letters to Valerie Jarrett and Michael Strassmanis, domestic advisor for the president. We got one response when we attempted to meet with the secretary over a year ago, was that from the White House, they identified the people at USDA was they were part of their family. I would not want to address some of those people that are responsible, that's overseeing civil rights and all the abuses at USDA, really as my family. I think what is happening at USDA has very close similarities to what is going on at Penn State. People in high positions at the Department of Agriculture under this administration are ignoring the abuse, assaults, rape, beatings, and not allowing people to process their complaints in a speedy and fair manner at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So I can only abbreviate what Ms. Donnelly had said. And we also attempted to work with this administration to stop a class action in the Forest Service on behalf of women and other minorities. And in lieu of them hoping they would work with the coalition, what they did was instead of going out to investigate the problems with the employees and get some accountability, they spent all their time investigating Lisa Donnelly and ignored most of the issues and concerns. And to this day, we have seen no report that was drafted or written with all the money that was spent, the taxpayers' money, to go out and said to do some compliance review to make sure USDA is doing what it's supposed to. It's not doing what it's supposed to. The transparency and accountability is not there, and this administration has failed and failed miserably. And I'm trying to figure out how can people go to the polls and vote for people, and when you find out that when you ask them for help, crying for help in the wilderness and help women, both in California and other places in USDA and other minorities, you're talking to a deaf ear and you get no response. Instead of a response, these people retaliate against you for speaking out. And these are very brave women, and I can't say enough to compliment their courage and the tenacity to stand up against all the abuse that's been thrown at them by USDA officials under this administration.
Lawrence C. Lucas of the USDA Coalition of Minority Employees. The folks that run the Philadelphia public schools want to shut down at least 40 schools and replace them with charter schools. The city's School Reform Commission has brought in a big business consulting firm from Boston to strip down the public school budget. The William Penn Foundation and the United Way of Southeastern Pennsylvania, both representing corporate interests, paid for the planning of the public school overhaul. We asked Jerry Jordan, head of the teachers union in Philadelphia, if what we're looking at is a hostile big business takeover of the public schools.
I think that's a pretty good assessment of what's happening here in Philadelphia. It is very clear that businesses are beginning to have more say about what happens in the schools than the parents and members of these communities here in Philadelphia, as well as the lack of hearing the teacher voice and the voice of the principals and other employees who work in schools, the people who know best how schools work and are able to really say these are the tools that we need in order for our schools to do the best job for our children.
Well, there seems to be an ideology at work that says that the teachers who work in the schools and the school employees are the problem.
Unfortunately, with many of the policies that are in place relative to public education in this country, specifically No Child Left Behind and the testing environment that has been put in place by the federal government since the passage of No Child Left Behind in about 2001, that, you know, it's been an era of just sanctions. And as the government continues to underfund school systems, particularly you see it across this nation in urban environments where you have a high population of minority parents and children, that those school systems are being underfunded, resources are being eliminated, such as music, art, physical education, after-school activities, and schools are giving, in too many instances, what I call a bare-bone education to children because non-mandated courses are treated as if they're frills so they can just easily be eliminated, when all of those courses are courses that help children to increase their learning. Here in Philadelphia this summer school was eliminated for our kids, and when we return next month, many of the non-instructional personnel who were there to help support the children, to help make sure that the schools are safe and it's a good learning environment for children to learn in and for teachers to teach, those individuals have been laid off. And then with the sanctions, you know, if the school is not performing well, based on the measures that they're using, they say, oh, well, then we need to convert this public school to a charter school.
And it does appear that this school reform commission is determined to make Philadelphia substantially a charter system.
Well, one of the proposals that the school reform commission put on the table back in the spring is that they plan on having 40% of Philadelphia students in charter schools. And to make that kind of a statement is really, really huge. But when we look at the research on charter schools in this nation, the Stanford University Credo study, which was done last year, and they did studies on Pennsylvania charter schools specifically, the majority of which are here in Philadelphia, that it shows that the vast majority of the charter schools are not doing as well as the neighborhood public schools. So it's really not a well thought out decision that they're making, and it's certainly not based on the research.
It seems that the only motivation must be ideology. And also, these charter schools, we hear, will cost additional millions to Philadelphia.
That's correct. Currently, the Philadelphia School District is spending almost $500 million out of its budget for charter schools right now, and they're going to be spending more. And as the increase in the number of charter schools takes place here, it means that money comes out of the budget, and therefore when money comes out of the budget, it's coming out of the classroom that children sit in. So they're going to have less resources in each of their schools. That isn't good. A moratorium, at least in Philadelphia, on expanding charter schools because of, at this point, the School Reform Commission is projecting a $282 million deficit for next year.
And they can't blame that on the teachers or the employees.
Well, they'll try. They'll try.
The teachers at least have a union to speak for them. But what kind of mechanisms are there for the parents to confront these drastic cuts in the services that are going to their kids?
Well, parents really need to be in touch with their elected officials and to ask the people who have been voted into office to represent their interest, to certainly speak on their behalf. But I think that the strategy has been such that parents, particularly in urban centers, too many of them are so inundated with trying to figure out ways to provide for their families. Many parents working two and three low-paying jobs in order to provide for their families, that they don't have time to attend some of the meetings, to be in touch with elected officials, and that I think the powers to be who have figured this out, and I think that it's happening, and as I talk to my colleagues in other urban centers in this country, the same thing is happening, whether it's in Chicago or Washington, D.C. or St. Louis, that, you know, parents just can't do it all. But hopefully we are trying to enlighten elected officials, and there are some parents here in Philadelphia who are very active, and they do understand what's happening, and they are speaking out, and their voices are being heard. This is just really such an assault on public education, and I really believe that if we don't change what's happening now, we're going to pay for this in a very short period of time, because, you know, failure to educate our children well means that we're going to have a price to pay as a society. I'll end on this note. It is very, very troubling when the budget that was adopted by the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania last year appropriated more money for the prison system than it did for the school system across the state of Pennsylvania.
Jerry Jordan, president of the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers. Is black radio headed for the dustbin of history? A number of black media organizations and activists fear that may be the case and sent a letter to the Federal Communications Commission requesting an investigation into the state of black broadcasting. We spoke with veteran broadcaster Davey D., host of the syndicated daily show Hard Knocks Radio.
I think the term black radio no longer really applies, except to say that there are black people on radio and there's a couple of black people who own some stations. But for the most part, radio in general, or at least commercial radio, acts pretty much the same. It draws from the same playbook. It's a commercial entity. It's about making money. The relationship between the labels and radio is incestuous and damaging, in the sense that those labels pay, or is the type of relationship where they dictate what you're going to hear over the desires and concerns of the community at large. And it's all about getting corporate dollars in terms of advertising. And so whether it's Clear Channel or Radio One, which is black owned, it's still the same thing at the end of the day. And if you go to different communities, and I'm speaking as somebody who's been on both black and pop radio, you see the complaints are pretty much the same. The white kids in the suburbs are complaining about the same top 10 songs. The kids in the hood are complaining about the same top 10 songs. The difference with black radio is that they figured out a long time ago that they don't have to be number one in a market in order to make money because of syndication. So you have the situation where Steve Harvey's in like everybody's household, and they say that's a good thing, but what gets lost is the local translation of information, news, and just the day-to-day life that people are experiencing. They don't necessarily get to hear that articulated on their airwaves because you have one guy who's in every 200-some-odd markets. And they figured out, well, why pay the local guy $100 when I can get the syndicated guy for $25, and I don't even have to be number one. It's easier to sell the syndicated guy by saying, well, look, I'm in New York, Los Angeles, Oakland, and Dallas and Houston, versus competing locally and saying I'm number one, two, or three in the marketplace, hence buy ads on my station, on my show. So that's been one of the unique pitfalls, I think, of black radio, is that it's just become a place where you can just hear syndication and not too much uniqueness on a local level. And then black radio, in many instances, is black by convenience. You know, black when they want to get extra advertising dollars and they want to play the black card and talk about how the community's not being served. They're black when they want to get maybe a show, or they want to get something that they feel that they commercially should have. Then they want to play the black card. But when you look at what's going on in the black community, say like the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement report showing every 36 hours African Americans are being shot, you don't see black radio leading the charge around how are we going to combat that? They'll do it with Trayvon, but they won't do it, say, around situations that might have just taken place here in Oakland with Alan Bluford or Romali Graham in New York. So what is black radio in 2012? Is it black faces on the radio dial, or is it black people who are going to be the voice that accurately reflects the sentiments of the community and will speak truth to power no matter what? I don't see that existing in large numbers the way that one might think when you see the term black radio.
So we're talking about black-oriented radio and a medium that largely has already met its demise in terms of servicing its audience.
Yeah. Again, what does it mean when you say service the audience? If you talk to black radio programmers, they're saying, well, we played the new 2 Chainz song, we played the new Jay-Z song, so we service the audience. Servicing is different than entertaining. And I think when you're talking about radio and what radio ideally should be a two-way conversation that is ongoing between those who broadcast and those who communicate. The corporate dictate means now in 2012 that I just broadcast to you. It means it's a one-sided conversation. I announce you listen. I announce you consume. Black radio at its height was always a back-and-forth dialogue. Even though I might have had the mic, I was just the ringleader or the ringmaster between ongoing conversation and a community. If Mrs. Jones didn't get along with Mr. Smith, I facilitated that on the air. If there was a hot issue, I brought all the parties together and we talked about that on the air. Those are the things that black radio ideally has done in the past. If there were marches and movements, I was key in orchestrating that. You saw that with Dr. King and the SCLC. The relationship that him and the SCLC had with Jack Gibson, or a.k.a. Jack the Rapper, when, you know, the headquarters was right there in the same building, the radio station and SCLC headquarters. They had a relationship where the radio station was able to get that information to the community, working in tandem with a major civil rights organization. You don't necessarily see that anymore. But then again, in 2012, many of our civil rights organizations are in the hands or in the pockets of those very same institutions that the radio stations are. They're corporate-owned and corporate-bought and corporate-sponsored. And so what we hear and what we're seeing is a reflection of that culture versus what I would say is black or African-American culture.
And, of course, local news on black-oriented radio has gone all but extinct.
You're right. Local news isn't there, but local news is morphed into entertainment news. So they do have news, but if you listen to a lot of the news, it centers around gossip. And, yeah, and that gossip is usually national in scope. So you're right. We'll all hear about the Jackson family drama. We'll hear Kanye and Kim Kardashian, but we won't hear about what the mayor's doing in a particular city. For example, here in San Francisco, you won't hear black radio talking about Ed Lee wanting to bring stop and frisk as a policy.
You're speaking of the mayor of San Francisco.
The mayor, right. So you won't hear that, even though you had 30,000 people marching in New York against that, and even though it's led to 2 or 3 deaths as a result of that. So you don't hear that conversation. You hear it on some shows. We played it. KPOO, which is, I think, operates in the tradition of black radio as a community station. They talk about it. But if I was to turn on, say, KNEL, which is black-oriented, or even KBLX, which Steve Harvey is now on, they ain't mentioning that at all. They're not going to talk about that. And so it would be non-existent. And so I could walk down the street right here in Oakland, California, and tell people, hey, he wants to bring stop and frisk and have people who only listen to those stations look at me and go, I didn't know that. How do you not know that? Well, Steve Harvey didn't talk about it. You know, why would he? He's not in San Francisco, but neither did the other jocks when they came on, because they're regulated by the format, the corporate format that all these stations follow, whether they're black-owned, white-owned, or whatever, which is you have 30 seconds to make an announcement in between songs, and those songs you can talk comes after every 3 or 4 songs, 10 after, 20 after, 22, and 10 to. So that's your typical clock. If I go to KML, which is the urban station in this market where most black folks under the age of 40 would probably listen, and they do have a number of black jocks on the air, you would never hear them mention that, and that's the audience that is most likely to be impacted by the stop and frisk policies. For example, we had a child that was shot and killed here last year. His name was Baby Harm. He's an African-American, 1 year old. The family held a press conference, and they talked about that. They wanted to stop the cycle of revenge. And so even though they lost their son or their grandson and their nephew, they candidly said that violence must end and it will stop with us. We will not seek revenge. They also mentioned that once upon a time that they may have caused drama in the community. And this is something that they have to reconcile with. And so there was a peace march. The community in West Oakland came together. They planted a tree. They honored the family for being an example of restorative justice. It's a beautiful thing, right? You didn't get no shout out on the radio about that, on Black radio. They didn't go down there and cover it. They didn't talk about it. They didn't bring attention to it. They didn't honor them. They didn't even include this in the local gossip. You were more likely to hear about a beef between two artists than you were about restorative justice efforts of people in the community or on the street who have been adversely impacted. That same scenario, you can go from New York to L.A. and see those efforts and see them absent in terms of the conversation on most Black-oriented stations.
And yet we know that Black people search out for Black product, or as Black a product as they can get, because we can infer that from the extremely high Black listener loyalty levels.
Right. But see, here's the problem, and here's the challenge. And just having been management at a station, let me give you what I've experienced. There's a hierarchy in terms of who you want as a buyer, in terms of how corporations look at it. So they have a thing, a ratings or a demographic scale. And basically, what they look at is they go, either we want white males, 25 to 54, that's the high buying advertiser. We want females who make the decisions in most of these houses for appliances and things like that. So we're looking 18 to 34. And then it goes down from there. Then you have demographics with the females, white women, Latino women, sisters. Then you go to teenagers. And we go all the way down the list. The people that are least desirable, the ones who they don't want, but are often used to validate, are Black males. And so what you find at the end of the day is that Black males are used to authenticate a particular trend, authenticate a type of genre that they're presenting, but Black males are not who they're trying to serve at the end of the day. They're trying to serve everybody else, especially those who don't even live in the community, who will be entertained by the foolishness that they hear on the air. They can turn it on, watch the quote-unquote jigaboos dance, sing, and talk, and then go about their business. And so at the end of the day, we wind up really not being served. Now, some radio stations will say, well, we go to super serve our community, and et cetera, et cetera. But I question that, because even they have discovered that they can get a sizable audience in many places that's outside the community, even if they're Black-owned, so they will ultimately start serving those interests. I mean, we've seen that when you go to certain Black neighborhoods, the soul food place, once they discover tourists come into town and they want to go to that soul food place, it stops being spicy. It doesn't have the same flavoring because they start to accommodate the taste of those outside the community who are coming in and want something Black, but they don't really want something Black. They want something that they're comfortable with that has a Black face or Black flavor or Black name on it. And so I think that's happened with radio and Black entertainment for the most part. The needs and wants of our community and the pushback and the type of dialogue that we really need to have is something that they've shied away from, whether it's completely Black-owned or whether it's Black-oriented in terms of being white-owned and having Black faces, because it doesn't sell at the end of the day.
Davey D. of Hard Knocks Radio, speaking from Oakland, California. A host of religious and labor organizations have announced a global boycott of the Hyatt hotel chain. Kim Bobo, executive director of Interfaith Worker Justice, explains.
Hyatt has really taken a low road path, particularly outside the handful of cities where they have unions. They've really moved into this perma-temp kind of approach where you hire a temporary staffing agency. These agencies act like they're temporary, but in fact these workers become long-term employees of the hotel, but hired by a temping agency in a way where the chain takes no responsibility for them as employees, or at least tries not to. And these perma-temps are paid minimum wage or just a little above. They have no vacation, no sick days, no health care. it's an employment practice that is a complete low-road practice, and there's no reason for it. I mean, the Hyatt hotel chain, this is not like a chain that's struggling to make ends meet. This is a very profitable company. They do very well in many markets, and even in markets where they're doing well, they've made a choice to hire these perma-temps via staffing agencies. It's a low-road approach that really is bad for workers, it's bad for the whole community, and we believe it's bad for the entire hotel sector.
In fact, the subcontracting of workers is something that's infested the office cleanup industry. One of the reasons that Local 32BJ's Justice for Janitors campaign came into being.
Absolutely. The subcontracting has been rampant for many years in the janitorial sector, and we've seen what that has done for workers. We've seen similar kinds of things with public sector workers trying to contract out workers in a way that really undermines middle-class jobs. But Hyatt is really leading that kind of low-road approach in the hotel sector, which is why it is so important that Hyatt be challenged to do better. It is capable of doing better. And in fact, the leadership of Hyatt is in Chicago. They're known, the Pritzker family that really owns Hyatt. I mean, they are really known for their charitable activities in Chicago. And so that they would take such a low-road approach, it just doesn't match with who they think they are or who they are in their charitable activities.
And this boycott and labor unrest has been a real embarrassment to the Pritzker family's friend, President Obama.
Yes, it is, because the Pritzker, particularly Penny Pritzker, is very connected to the campaign. As you probably saw, there was recently an article about her and the connection in the New York Times. But you know what? There were some easy ways to solve this. All Hyatt has to do is really make a commitment that they're going to respect workers' rights to organize, they're going to reduce the pressures on housekeepers to clean a ridiculous number of rooms, and they're going to stop this outsourcing to temp agencies of their core workforce and really accept the responsibility as an employer of the folks that work in your hotels. Those are not hard demands for the Hyatt Hotel to accept.
And we would think that the Black and Latino religious community would be deeply involved, since most of Hyatt's workers on the cleanup end are Black and Latino.
Absolutely. We will see lots of support from the historically Black religious tradition, so the AMEs and the AME Zion and the National Baptists and the Progressive Baptists and the Church of God in Christ. Absolutely, those will be involved. The U.S. Catholic Conference, increasingly, 40% of Catholics in the country right now are Latino. They have made it very clear we only contract with union hotels, and while they haven't signed a pledge yet supporting the boycott, but I know, because I've been talking to a lot of the leadership, that people will figure out how they can be supportive of this boycott. I think the evangelical community, in terms of the Latino evangelical community, which of course is very significant, we are beginning conversations with a number of those organizations. And again, I suspect that they will be supportive of the boycott as well. So I think we will see lots of diverse, very diverse support for this boycott.
Kim Bobo of Interfaith Worker Justice. The United States and its allies continue to deliver money, arms, and all manner of support to the gunmen attempting to topple the government of Syria. Just as in the NATO war against Libya last year, the Obama administration claims its push for regime change is motivated by humanitarian concerns. That's nonsense, says Chris Gravreau of UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition.
The claim that this is a humanitarian intervention is thoroughly false, and we only have to look at the past military interventions of the U.S., NATO, and the U.N. in the Middle East, South Asia, and the entire region to see that that could not possibly be true. The so-called humanitarian intervention in Libya, of course, was a disaster recognized by all, leading not to democracy, but another elite regime characterized by a lot of odious policies, including racism against Black Africans. Now, in Syria today, we know that the U.S. and NATO has been perfectly happy to work in the past with the Assad regime on renditions of Iraqi victims of U.S. imperialism. Today, they're happy to work with remnants of that regime, exiles from that regime, the Syrian elite, who over the past period have called for U.S. military intervention and for sanctions that we know that are deeply hurting the civilian population today in Syria. I think this intervention, like all the interventions recently, is about getting ahead of the Arab Spring, suppressing or weakening or obliterating any real genuine democratic attempt to get rid of the dictatorships in the Middle East and subverting those and trying to turn them into victories in new hegemony for the U.S. and European elites in the region. So in the end, they're there for oil, they're there for gas, they're there for some geopolitical benefits against their rivals, their imperialist rivals in China, Russia, and they're up to no good. We have to oppose that intervention 100%.
And the United States has no problem dealing with jihadi right-wing Arab forces as it did in Libya, now in Syria.
Well, the U.S. has, beginning with the war in Afghanistan originally, helping to mobilize, work with Islamist forces to defeat pro-Soviet and Soviet elements in Afghanistan. At the same time, I do believe there are probably democratic elements on the ground in Syria who happen to be Islamist, who have been part of local coordinating committees or whatever with the intention of getting rid of a dictatorship. But clearly the forces that are taking arms and funds, sharing sanctions from the U.S. are not in that category. So I think the U.S. can work with just about everybody in the region and has, except a genuine democratic, you know, mass movement of working people and farmers.
President Obama claims that the United States is not supplying arms. Does that claim have any credibility?
Well, not with me. I guess they can try to parse it very finely, but of course the U.S. at the time of the June 30th international meeting and earlier in the spring announced that they were fully supportive of arms coming from their close allies, allies to whom they sell military weapons, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, etc., to the opposition elements that they support, and recently announced, what was it, $72 million in encryption, hacking, and video equipment. They give night goggles, and of course, there's very credible reports that the CIA is training elements of the opposition that they think that they can control in southern Turkey.
And so the United States supplies all kinds of war-related services, and its allies supply the guns.
That seems to be the case. And, of course, they're beefing up very directly their own naval force in the region, establishing new missile bases in collaboration with Qatar and so forth in the Gulf. We know that this escalation is there because they believe that they might want to use it.
There also seems to be a pattern in terms of how the United States tries to frame its involvement. With Iraq, we saw the coalition of the willing. In Syria, we have the friends of Syria. These ad hoc groupings that have no international legal standing, but that the United States behaves as if they do.
Well, a part of the effort of the U.S. administration to appeal to people in the U.S. population is to make it appear that they're part of an international effort that's based on an objective evaluation, some sort of universal support for human rights. But of course, we know that whenever the big powers are involved, that their own interests are discernible just below the surface, and the hypocrisy of the U.S. government and NATO, who are dripping with blood from Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, asserting with a straight face that they're defending human rights is ludicrous.
And yet we see folks here in the United States who would claim that they are of the left, that they are progressive politically, who are parroting Obama talk.
Well, recently we've seen some really sad cases, a few wouldn't say important, but some left commentators who get a hearing actually supporting U.S. intervention and the U.S. sending arms to forces in Syria. Sam Bin, a prominent Occupy activist, came out with this position recently. But, of course, history tells us that there is no way to play this game. When imperialist forces intervene in a country, the first forces that they kill are those that for whom they have no history of collaboration. And that, of course, is always the genuine revolutionaries on the ground, because they can make a deal with bureaucrats, they can make a deal with former ministers in a capitalist regime and a capitalist army and all sorts of other forces. Think, for example, of the situation in Iraq before the shock and awe in the decade of sanctions between the wars, so to speak. There was an uprising in Iraq against Saddam Hussein, and the U.S.'s response basically was to ignore it, to strangle it, and to bomb it. So any idea that by hook or crook, elements of the opposition could take some intervention, some sanction, some aid, and somehow end up with a democratic regime is just a utopian idea. Unfortunately, the only way forward for folks who want democracy in Syria is to struggle independently on the ground, independent of imperialism, and in a way that leaves them free to shape a society in their own interest.
And that's it for this week's Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.